Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Better Than Life, where comedians come to talk Red Dwarf, episode by episode. I'm John, old school fan on my first rewatch in decades.
And I'm Fergus, your co-host and big time big fan. Big time. We're joined by our producer Alex. This time we're doing Series 2, Episode 4, Stasis Leak, with David Reed.
Let's take a voice to Trip Out City.
It's a show about a man who's lost 3 million years in space. His company had evolved. A fuzzy robot and a ship that's gone senile. We love the jokes and sci-fi stuff, that's why it's better than life.
Our guest this episode is playwright and comedian, Mr. David Reed. He is the writer and performer of massively successful sketch and character comedy, both live and on BBC Radio 4. As well as a string of historical comedy plays, many of which you can get your ears around on streaming platforms. He's also an acclaimed comedy improviser, all of which means he is primed to have his brains picked clean about the greatest ongoing 20th century British sci-fi sitcom of all time, Red Dwarf. David, welcome aboard the Better Than Life podcast.
Hey. Thank you for having me. This is very exciting. Talking about Red Dwarf in public, I feel a bit strange about it, but it's going to be good. I was saying only recently that Red Dwarf seems to be a sitcom that unites a lot of comedy professionals who don't speak in public, in case the kids who used to do sport at school here and they get beaten up. No, I absolutely love it. I'm very happy to be here.
Where did it all start for you, David? What was the first exposure to Red Dwarf for you?
So I watched it on TV when it first came out. I had a conversation with my dad only this week, actually. He said he ummed and ahed over whether Red Dwarf was appropriate for a six-year-old to watch. And he thank God he decided, yes, it was absolutely fine. So it's influenced a lot of what I've done from then on in, trying desperately to combine adventure and comedy. But I also confided in him that he probably wasted his time deliberating over that, because my mum had already let me watch The Shining a year ago by that point. My dad recorded it all onto VHS early doors, and then I watched it again and again and again.
Was he pre-screening the episodes on VHS before he'd show them to you, or were you watching them live and then re-watching the recording?
I will have been 6-7 years old when the first two series came out, so I've no idea. I mean, I don't think I would have had a concept of my dad screening stuff. He exists only to serve. That is the six-year-old's opinion of the world. It was one of those sitcoms that people of any age could enjoy it. I think it's got that appeal. It's from that pre-Simpsons era, certainly in this country. Early on, Simpsons was only on Sky One, and you had to have a Sky dish in order to watch it, whereas Red Dwarf was on terrestrial.
Yeah.
But that thing of, like, even if a joke goes over your head, you know, you're learning what everyone else is laughing about, and you want to catch up. So
yes.
I definitely had that with sitcoms growing up, that
absolutely.
I feel they were part of my education in terms of how to communicate with other people.
Yeah.
I still remember my dad defining the word infallible for me out of this episode.
Right, okay. I probably irritatingly said to my parents on a regular basis, "What is it?" about anything.
Who hasn't?
Anything I didn't understand.
Of course.
Because Kat is the child in the room. Thinking back to that time in my life and sort of opening old files, I've not opened in a very long time, but my mum used to teach yoga for pregnant women in our in our living room. So me and my dad were banished to the TV room. And on Wednesday nights when my mum taught, it would be Star Trek The Next Generation, which I think is massively linked to Red Dwarf, just in terms of you can chart the episodes that Star Trek do and then Red Dwarf do like a year later. Yeah. Like Camille is literally the name of the chameleon sexy woman in Red Dwarf. In Star Trek,
but
sorry.
But that's tricky, isn't it? Both creators love a pun.
Well, exactly. Maybe it's a common thought rather than a direct ripoff, but I've just felt that you had that common language.
David, I want to circle back to the beginnings of your fandom, but I've got to ask, did you stick with Red Dwarf the whole way?
100%. I've watched all of the new ones, Back to Earth and Beyond. I mean, my wife is a big fan as well, so that's helped for sort of putting it on of an evening to see where they're up to and what they're doing. I've been lucky enough to work with a few of the cast as well, which has been amazing. There's some of the people that I still sort of feel a bit starstruck by.
I bet.
Yeah.
Like,
Drop a few names.
Go on then. Yeah, I'll tell you.
It's fine.
I do all of Kevin Eldon's stuff on the radio and when he had his TV series as well, and got to meet Hattie Hayridge through doing that.
Wow.
Actually, no, I'd worked with her before on an improv tour. Now I come to think of it, I have to tell you this story. Sorry, you've opened my Red Dwarf file in my head. So I did a tour of a show called Totally Looped, which was live overdubbing of movies with the sound off in front of an audience, but you weren't prepped what the clips were going to be. And we were told you may sort of make mistakes or talk when you're not supposed to be talking, but the cardinal rule is just, if you don't know what to say, just say something, make a noise, so that when their mouth is flapping, you're making a noise. And Hattie, they got as a sort of star stunt casting on this tour. And bless her, improv is not her... It's not her background, you know.
She has quite a languorous pace of delivery as well.
So nearly every clip that Hattie did, she'd be playing a character. And she took their advice literally. She just went, oh, throughout the entire clip whenever her character was speaking. And occasionally a word would come to her and she'd just go, oh, thank you. But that was the entire thing. And to be fair, it's an incredibly hard thing to do when you're just suddenly given a clip from Jaws and you have to sort of fill in whenever your character is speaking. But I met her and got to know her from doing that. And then she was filming on It's Kevin Eldon's sketch show that we did together. And I literally arrived in the studio and the runner was about to offer me a coffee when clearly someone had said something in her earpiece and she went, I'm so sorry. Can you find your way from here? And she just disappeared. I was left in the corridor of a studio I didn't know. I was like, what is happening? It turned out at the exact moment I'd arrived, Hattie Hayridge had walked backwards in one of those green screen studios. I don't know if you know the term, but infinity curve, where it curves so you can't see the edge. But she'd walked back, fallen over and snapped her ankle in the exact moment I arrived in the studio. So bless her. She filmed all of her things just head and shoulders like a week later in a full cast. But she's lovely. She's an absolutely lovely person and is brilliant.
Yeah, and two stories of her being very sensible and aware of her surroundings.
Oh, no, she's as mad as a box of frogs, but she's very charming with it. I actually did a gig with both Hollies. It was both Hollies and Michael Winslow Jones from Police Academy.
Yeah. Sound effects.
Right? Yeah, during a World Cup. So we were all sat in the courtyard outside this theatre, me and the two Hollies, me not knowing how to talk to them, whilst Michael Winslow did whatever he does, Smoke on the Water or whatever he's doing on his own, was just piped through as we were watching the football.
Oh, that's lovely.
Absolutely lovely.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
It's really hard though, isn't it, to meet those people
you've
known deeply for 30 years.
Every ounce of your being is trying to be a peer of theirs, not a fan of theirs. And so you're second guessing whether you're allowed to talk about Red Dwarf or not, which they must be around a lot in there. I had a wonderful experience with Danny John-Jules, but he wouldn't recognize me from Adam because I used to do a live band karaoke show. It's how my wife and I met. She was the bassist, I was the drummer, where we'd invite comedians on. And Ben Miller from Armstrong and Miller would always appear just out of nowhere carrying his plastic shopping bag, come up on stage, still holding the bag weirdly, do a song and then disappear forever. And we'd have a 24-piece orchestra in this show as well.
Wow.
And then one day he arrived with Danny John-Jules and sang a duet. But no, that was amazing to drum for Danny John-Jules because he's got a set of pipes on him.
Yes, he has. He's still releasing singles, though. He's still releasing music.
Yeah.
Did he give you a bit of hot shoe as well? Was he moving?
No, but he was dressed very coolly.
Yeah,
like, he just looked awesome. I have a photo of him on stage that night on my sitting room wall.
Oh, so fantastic.
Oh.
Anyway, that's my slightly embarrassing, I don't have really a connection with Red Dwarf stories out the way. I did go to a recording once. I got to know the DOP of it. And so I was in the audience for Twentica, which is one of the new ones. And that was amazing. Me and my wife got to sit in Starbug and she broke it.
How did she, did she press the wrong buttons?
It's just a very flimsy set. She just leant on something and it snapped off. Also, I had it on good authority from the DOP that Robert now had his lines piped in through an earpiece so he didn't have to learn them. So that's why all of his were slightly behind and then they'd just edit out the gaps. And Chris Barry was reading all of his off post-it notes on Starbug, which is why Rimmer's always very interested in the navigation console. I felt for the actors because literally Doug Naylor had rewritten whole pages the night before and just handed it to them.
Yeah, but this is also the era that he was also directing.
Yes, yes.
And was sole exec producer on it, I think, as
and
well.
And that is why he was allowed to do this, I think. Yeah. TV was evolving into something with new cameras and new ways of filming things. And Chris Barry was left behind in the old way. And he was doing it massive.
Yeah.
But Rimmer and Brittas, there's a lot of Chris Barry in Alan Partridge, I think.
Yeah.
It's a point in the history of British comedy is it's not this weird little side spur, actually. You know, I think it's massively significant.
Brittas always felt a little too much like they were trying to create a classic British sitcom character.
Yeah, I agree. Of the old school as well. You know, the template they set out in series one and two of Red Dwarf is such a complex loser who thinks he's a winner that, like, that is always the funniest character in anything.
Yeah.
That's Brent, that's Partridge, that's everything that people have loved since, you know.
It's Hancock and Fulton.
Yeah, absolutely, you're right. No, I think Rimmer is probably the best sitcom character from this show. But I love them all. But, you know, I think he's arguably the lead because he's the most interesting.
Does that mean he's the best objectively as well as being your favourite? Or do you have a different favorite character?
I don't know, because it's a gang. I don't like thinking about them separately. I've often thought, you know, I've always identified with Dave Lister more, but because you're supposed to.
Yeah.
And I think growing up, I wanted to be Lister, but always had a sneaking suspicion that parts of me were Rimmer. And I think that's I think that's probably the appeal. Lister is so sort of laid back and chilled about everything. And yet, weirdly, they sometimes play that he's an idiot, but he's often really erudite and knowledgeable and philosophical and all the rest, you know. And it's because they cast a poet and lent into that, I think. Mm. And I think that gives his everyman a real nice flavour that you don't get in a lot of sitcoms, you know. They're a great team. I think they're all there, you know. All of the archetypes set out by the ancient Greeks and then A.A. Milne are all there in that Lister is Winnie the Pooh, let's be honest. He's, instead of honey, it's curry, but he's a bear of very little brain. And Rimmer is a really uptight sort of crossover between Piglet and Rabbit, to be honest. And Cat is Tigger, quite obviously. Holly is definitely Eeyore. you know, it's all there.
As a six-year-old, was it the existential questions about humanity and the nature of what it is to be human that really hooked you, or was it something else?
Arguably, it's more sci-fi in series one and two, and then fades, or maybe starkly in series three, actually turns into space opera.
You know, it's more conceptual, isn't it, in the first couple of series?
Yeah, it's trying to be more fun and more and bring more people with it. I mean, the first two series are very much, here's a sci-fi concept, let's write humans going through that. Like, they don't lean into the sci-fi, you know, how do we reverse the polarity back to the future of it all, really, at all. They just Rimmer and Lister react to what is happening to them and do long speeches like this is a play, which is very much the old sitcom mold, you know. As I say, before the cameras became lighter, easier to carry around. But I love series one and two. Like, lots of people, so for some Red Dwarf fans, it starts in series three. I'm not having that.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm meandering around too much. I'm just excited someone's talking to me about Red Dwarf, to be honest.
Could you pinpoint a favourite episode, or is that too hard?
That's incredibly difficult. I could probably tell you the one I watched the most.
Yeah.
Probably Justice. It's because it's a character crunch point of them ripping Rimmer's personality apart to save him.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I think that's a glorious conceit. And it's all leading up to that point. And the idea of the Justice Field is just really, really fun. Both sci-fi device and comedic device. I mean, and that's when it's at its best, is when they manage to find something that is both.
A question we ask everybody, and it's fiendish. If, just suppose, they were going to reboot Red Dwarf, who would you cast?
Can we do the necessary caveats first, that it's always a bad idea? And it was of its time, so the idea of making it now, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, that's fine.
I think an American movie franchise would be where I'd go with it. Lister is the hardest one to recast because they just ended up writing Craig Charles, right? Mm. The fact he's from Liverpool is intrinsic to the character.
Yeah.
You know, and so you go, well, could Stephen Graham play it? No.
Yeah, well, God.
Like, that doesn't work. And so I think... who I sort of went, I could see him. Also, schlub is not a common character trait anymore. I think we got too many early 2000s films about grown men who haven't grown up yet, and people just got saturated by it. And so now everyone's sort of a bit more go-getting, and, you know, they go to the gym and they've got their life together. So it's harder to cast people who are that type. But someone who I think still does occupy that type is Tracy Morgan.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting casting.
And then I need somebody who's going to play as big as Tracy Morgan. And I'm in two minds about my Rimmer. I would say it's... I think I'm going to go Bob Odenkirk.
Oh, yeah.
As Rimmer. Although my second choice is Will Arnett.
Both great.
Rimmer is fine as long as he's utterly full of himself and then reality tears him down. So, you know.
Actually, yeah, that's great for a proper actor. Yeah, great. Not that Chris Parry's not a proper actor.
I'm quite proud of my choice for Kat, because it's got to be somebody who is larger than life and sort of somehow almost inhuman. And so I went for sort of like a rock star kind of figure. Janelle Monáe.
Oh, what did I see her in really recently? Glass Onion,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, she's in Glass Onion.
Yes. Yeah, brilliant. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant.
Crichton is a really hard one to cast, I think, because he's got that Catholic guilt, but then there's something of the Jewish mother about him as well. I actually thought someone who has funny bones but can play that worried mother hen figure is David Schwimmer.
Oh, yeah.
What a cast. It's quite... I'm going to need to step up the budget a little bit.
Yeah, I'm afraid we're going to have to go. Wow. But we are going to do models, guys. We're not going CGI. That's a line in the sand for me.
That's it's fair.
We're going to do practical effects again. Practical effects. To offset the budget, I've gone for the person that I think fills Norman Lovett's shoes the best out of the current crop of British comedians, and that's Joe Wilkinson.
Oh, lovely.
Lovely.
This is a great cast.
I think he would only be, he would be better up against big American names. I think it would only make him funnier.
Let's dig into the episode. Fergus is going to remind us what happens in the masterpiece that is Stasis Leak.
Thanks, John. So, following a joke from Holly, better suited to 80s Rick Mail, I think, we're treated to the first proper flashback this series. It's 3 million years ago, when the ship was fully crewed and thriving. Look, it's Captain Arlister, and he still has less time for Rimmer than even Lister does. Rimmer's complaining that Lister got him tripping on freaky fungus and ends up insulting his way to 8 weeks PD. Hang on, who was that guy who walked past Dave and Arn covering his face and speaking with Rimmer's voice? Ah, probably nothing. 5 minutes in, the story starts. Lister's found a photo of himself at Kachansky's wedding, and he's assumed he's the groom. Surely impossible without some kind of wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey... Oh no, it's fine. Luckily, an opportunity for time travel presents itself pretty quickly. A stasis leak on floor 16. The boys arrive at Nivello Deck Says to find an ominous green glow, and they're suddenly 3 million years in their past. They establish the rules of time travel, and Rimmer and Lister work out, through arguments, insults, and self-loathing diatribes, naturally, that they might be able to save someone by convincing them to go into stasis during the drive plate catastrophe. Worth noting, it never occurs to either of them to try to save the entire crew by warning them of said catastrophe. Anywho, Rimmer sneaks into the past while Lister and Kat make their way back to the stasis leak, keeping up morale by laughing and saying yeah over and over again. We see the colour version of Rimmer trying to convince himself not to die, and then Hollister comes in his chicken costume, deepening Rimmer's sense that he's still as high as a kite. He reacts violently, and even though iPlayer has cut the knee to the balls, Hollister gets mighty, mighty mad. Meanwhile, Lister and the cat visit the Ganymede Holiday Inn, staffed by some truly terrifying robots, and discover that Chrissy is already married. But wait, Claire Grogan's back! Yay! And Dave is the groom, albeit with an evil twin-style beard. Thanks to some double-double future chat, everything somehow works out great but sad. Like Lister's whole life, I guess. We end on a scene of Rimmer being driven completely insane by the presence of three Listers and another him and a floor manager wearing a big hat to cover up the fact that they'd accidentally let CP Grogan go before she'd filmed all of her scenes. Then a third Rimmer shows up with a pencil moustache, so we know he's evil, and prime Rimmer's psyche explodes. And that's Stasis Leak, an episode full of Series 1 cameos. Mark Williams' Olaf Peterson returns to the show for the last time. Even Tony Hawk is back as a suitcase. So, David, where do you want to start? Or should we just go straight to the elevator scene?
Oh, I love the elevator scene. I love this episode. I've watched it twice since you told me I was coming on the show. And I went back and watched the Series 1 episode Balance of Power as well to get a taste of the list of romantic episodes. Although, thanks for the memory, is obviously a romantic one, but just less Kachansky heavy. You said something really interesting, I think, which I am nostalgic for, which is, you're right, they don't try and rescue the whole crew. And the only reason for that is that continuity is not really a thing. Like, series continuity isn't a thing. And it's more fun if we never go there. Like, this episode never comes back.
It's true. Is there still a stasis leak on floor 16 during, say, series 10?
Right. Or yeah, exactly. Or that Lister eventually marries Kachansky never seems to be a thing. And I think that's because it's from a different time. Like, if it was remade, as we've just been talking about, all of these things would be parked on a post-it note on an enormous wall in a writing room somewhere and would have to be brought back in whenever it was relevant. And it would just get all a bit tight and annoying. That point aside, I think it's really nice going back and seeing Lister react to Peterson, for instance.
Yeah, that's lovely.
But there's just, it's a really funny episode. As well as the knee in the balls, I think they also sub down the amount of man's bare ass you got to see in the shower scene as well.
They reshot it, I think.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah.
When they shot it before the studio audience, the actor didn't really want to be naked, and then it kind of defeated the purpose of the scene. So they went back and refilmed it after recording.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Wow. And they cut a few You've Got a Small Willy lines as well.
Yes. I mean, I don't know where to start on this episode because there's a lot. What I do like about, again, it's, I suppose, spending some time in the way it used to be by going back to 1988 television, is that it just ends. And I love that. Like, it just ends with all yeah, of this unresolved mess.
Yeah.
And Rimmer just...
It literally hasn't occurred to me.
No, he just shouts, go away. And it, and we do.
That's it. That's it. He was given the direction, why don't you walk to camera as you're saying that so you can do your own blackout as well.
That's it, through your and gob.
Yeah, that's just the yeah, end of that story.
I mean, that is the practical version of a Looney Tunes circle wipe, isn't it? Like iris wipe. Zooming into Chris Barry's mouth.
It's true.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed it. And it did blow my mind as a kid as well. Just like in the way, I suppose, for young children, Back to the Future did or whatever. That, you know, just playing these very simple but time travel games of who's who. And I'm talking about that final scene, really, where everyone's coming in and you can play it for farce. Kat saying, what is it? It's still one of my all-time favourite Red Dwarf moments.
Yes.
It's the quality of taking a sci-fi concept and then milking every possible laugh you can get out of it, like having they're just doing an airline sketch with Morwenna Banks in the lift, but where death is certain if anything goes wrong. Like the cyanide capsule bit is brilliant.
Yes, it is brilliant.
You know,
that is brilliant.
Her performance of it as well. I watched her as she went. Specifically to see whether her smile cracks at all, and it doesn't. She's just the exact same rictus grin as she goes over.
Perfect timing. It's perfect timing. I remember being quite concerned for her as a kid.
Right. She's dead.
Yeah. She sacrificed her life to point out how other people may sacrifice theirs.
Yeah.
Instead of just being pancaked, which surely, well...
But you're into those dark details when you're a kid. You don't go, oh, well, how horrible. How horrible that we're laughing at that poor woman. You don't, because she's in control here, not you. She's the one who's just, you know, she's the one on TV.
Yeah, that's true. I was too busy, I think, yet again, and this has come up every episode, in this first two series it comes up a lot, the Esperanto. So, turns out Esperanto for Express Lift is Expressa Lifto.
Of course it is.
But they miss out, in the same way that they miss out the E of express, so it's a cool word that starts with X, they simply miss out the E at the start of expressor, so it becomes expressor. marvellous bit of rubbish world building.
It's mystifying that we're not all speaking Esperanto, really, isn't it? Given what we've learned about it so far.
Yeah, like a language that literally no one spoke. How did that not catch on? Another standout moment for me as well as a kid, as in that the whole thing is just lodged in my brain permanently, is Lister's hotel corridor speech, having lost hope that he's going to marry the love of his life.
Why is it always wine?
Sensible, reliable, dependable.
The delivery.
Yeah,
it's absolutely brilliant. And I think probably set the template for what they would try and repeat other series, you know. It's a funny episode, this one, as well. Like, it doesn't feel like a classic for some reason. I don't really even know what I mean by that. I mean, people will mention Better Than Life or Gunman of the Apocalypse, or this just feels like another episode. But it's fantastic.
I know what you mean. Better Than Life does extend our understanding of the depths of self-loathing that Rimmer has inside himself.
Yes.
Gunman is clearly a great story played out, and a great parody of another story played out really nicely.
Yeah,
this should be in the favourites. It's got all the series one guests apart from Robert Bathurst coming back. It's wonderful. It's like a little warm bath you can slip into. I wouldn't be surprised if they kind of pitched it as being the start of series two. It's weird that it comes fourth episode in as well, because it really is hidden in the series.
Yeah, that's often, if you've got a slightly mediocre one, you can stick it out fourth or fifth, because at least people have watched half the series by the time they get to it, and they'll probably stick with it to the end. It must be so irritating as a writer if you've spent all of this time making sure everything lines up and resolves beautifully and, you know, has been building slowly, and then they go, right, we're going to make number four number one. You just go, oh, God.
What does that do to an actor? Like, as an actor yourself, like, John and I have done some actings, but I don't think we've ever been in that privileged position where you get to explore how to build a character out of order across a long time.
I'm blessed enough to have only ever been once and done. So even in my own things that I write, they're all anthology. So, record once, get it done, move on.
Nice. Do you not have a yearning, a hankering for development?
Oh, yeah, no, not development. No, God, no, that's the worst. it must be a different job when you're told that your character is going to have this arc over, whatever it is, 6, 12, 26 episodes. Mm. And you might film them out of order and then the scenes within those out of order and keeping track of who you are. I work with Rafe Spall. I've worked with him a couple of times, actually. But he said something that I thought was really interesting, which was, if we have a role in this at all, it's being custodians of these characters. It's their job to protect the character because that is what people come back for.
That's really interesting.
And it's so easy for the character because it's so ephemeral, such a delicate balance. It's so easy for character to go missing and to start saying things and doing things because we don't have time to think about it that then get broken. And that's when the audience doesn't know why they don't like this show anymore, but they don't like it anymore. And so actually, I'm all in favour of, if an actor is good at what they're doing, they should be able to throw their toys out of the pram if they're not being listened to.
I completely agree with you, but on the other side of things, on the production side of things, it is upsetting when an actor says, my character wouldn't do that.
100%, and especially in a comedy. Because often the reason you're doing it is because it's funny. And so it's your job to find a reason why that's truthful.
Justifying
the jokes.
Not
the other way around.
Oof, yeah.
Yeah. No, I totally. And I have experience of actors doing that on shows and just killing laughs,
Oof.
Yeah. Oof. So it's a balancing act, like all things, But I thought that was interesting because definitely in the later series of this, characters are... they become caricatures of themselves. They don't have the same rigidity as they did in the first 6 series.
I think Chloe Annette's a really interesting case study. I think she's very funny, but they did her the disservice of trying to replace Rimmer with her and wrote a funny part of her characteristics in after the fact of her already being on the show. They decided, what will make her funny is if we play into her neuroses of geekery and being very uptight. In a different way to Rimmer, and she was already on screen by then.
Yeah, and being very sort of middle class as well. I mean, that isn't who Lister was in love with. Like, that she's obsessed with Jane Austen world and having a quiet evening to herself or whatever in Duct Soup or what, any of those. Like, she's quite pampered. And Claire Grogan is, just... You understand why, without them ever having to explore it through scenes, you understand why Lister is in love with that woman.
Yeah, someone he can go toe-to-toe with. And yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So they basically lose the romantic possibilities, I think, with the recharacterization with Chloe Annette.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Given that you watch Balance of Power as well, let's talk about the romance between Kochansky and Lister and the timing of it, let's say. When Lister and Kochansky are flirting in series 1, episodes 1 and 3,
yes,
was she already married to evil twin beard Lister?
No, she can't have been. No.
It would, for me, that would justify her relaxed sense of, it's almost like arrogant flirting she's doing with him. Do you know what I mean? Like, don't worry about it. We're already together. You just don't know it yet.
Oh, wow. I mean, no, I've never thought of it in that way. I think it's too creepy. It's like Tom Hanks in You've Got Mail, where as soon as he discovers their true identities, he then keeps it to himself for a while so he can toy with her. Like, that's not romantic. I think it loses something if that's true. Yeah, it's the halfway point. I just really like their energy, that they're just two people who just look into each other's eyes, and they there's so many stages of dating ahead of most other people.
Yeah, that's true.
And then
you see her going to Fiji. You could see Claire Grogan going to Fiji.
Yeah, on a whim.
Because if she can marry that beard, I'm sorry to keep coming back to it, but blimey, right?
But aside from the logistics of it, I think this is why it's not held up as a classic, this episode, because it doesn't give us what we want. I don't think. It's not. It gives us a happy ending for Lister in which we're not going to be at all invested, because we just think, oh, right, well, we're going to watch 5 years' worth of plot. At some point, then he's going to grow a beard, and then he's just
and as soon as he starts shaving the sides, we're like, it's coming.
Exactly. Yeah. He's going to travel back in time, and it's all going to work out.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not, it doesn't happen, obviously, but it's also not satisfying. It's not what we want, I don't think. We're invested in the longing and the lot, and it takes all of that away to think, oh, well, it's going to be fine then.
I agree. I mean, showing the end without a twist. Before you've got there. Very hard to place in a satisfying way. And where's Kat gone as well? That's worrying.
Yes, he disappears when the
Kuchansky and...
there's no double-double Kat.
Lister and Rimmer are still hanging out for some reason, but Kat's gone.
Oh, no. Yeah. Oh, no.
We don't know what Kat's lifespan is.
I wanted to talk about Kat in this episode. He doesn't actually have anything to do in the episode story-wise. But he is incredible in this episode. The repetition of what is it that David you mentioned?
Yeah.
The stole that he thinks is strangling.
That's beautiful.
She does the most extraordinary extra background artist work. By the way, do check her out during that scene, because yes, she's like she's in a Looney Tunes cartoon. Oh my! And runs off. If I'm not me, who's eating this chicken? Much good stuff. But none of it a part of the action.
But it's truthful to the character. He's never met people. Like, that his journey is that he gets to see women for the first time and he doesn't know what to do. For all he's got this Lothario energy. That's a fascinating insight into Kat, I think.
It is a sad show. Lister is up for sacrificing his life to be in love for 3 weeks in this episode.
But then he's so human in that a moment later, when he realizes that isn't possible, and, you know, does his great speech, and then she opens the door and the light of hope comes in again, and then he with a rubbish beard walks out of the bathroom. He's going through the roller coaster here, but he's so human by his reaction to seeing he does get the girl in the end. His reaction is, that guy, you know. It's not a hero's reaction. It's a comedic character's reaction, and that's why we feel for him more, I think.
They both know it. Evil beard. Lister does still shout.
I love that you call him evil. I don't know why.
No,
evil.
It's the beard that's evil specifically. Rimmer and Lister, neither of them are necessarily immoral. I just mean, they are sporting what is traditionally in sci-fi seen as, oh, that's a red flag. That's offense to your very fine moustache, but it's very different to a pencil moustache or an evil twin goatee, or in the case of Dave Lister in this episode, just whatever that merkin he's got stuck to his neck and chin. It's got to be evil.
It's an odd sort of, it's a beatnik beard he's sporting, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it.
It's quite jazz.
Yeah, that's it. Yes, it's a jazz beard. He's wearing a jazz beard.
It's a jazz
beard. I'll no longer refer to it as an evil twin style beard. It is from now a jazz beard. Very nice. Can I lay some hot, geeky facts on you?
Please do.
Lister and Rimmer live on floor 2583. I worked that out with maths. The size of Red Dwarf, and thank you to Red Dwarf Nerd on YouTube for these measurements. If you cut the ends of the ship off to make pretty much a hexagonal tube. Red Dwarf's smallest floors at the top and the bottom of that hexagon cover 5.5 square miles. The bigger ones in the middle cover about 11 square miles. So the average floor size is around 8.5 square miles. We know that there are at least 2,583 floors, so a total floor space. And yes, we can subtract some of this for engines and storage, but still, total floor space on Red Dwarf is a touch over 22,000 square miles. That's twice the size of Wales. So it's no wonder they upped the number of crew members in later series, because 169 is not enough people to inhabit two Waleses.
They've got two scutters to help out.
That's true, but they're often in the cinema. There's a lot of it is diesel decks, to be fair.
Through which you can go on a trek, apparently, if you wear laydowns.
That's it, yeah. Right? And I love that a spaceship can be still be powered by diesel. That would be...
the diesel decks.
Does your maths account for the size of Lister in the opening crawl when he's painting the outside of the ship? Because he does not look like he's on two Waleses. On the outside of it.
In terms of the interior floor space.
Okay.
So.
Oh, I see.
We're not talking about volume.
Okay, I see.
We're talking about the amount of ground
right.
you could walk.
Yeah, your footprint. Your footprint is two Waleses. Okay, got you. Really, PD is a pretty petty punishment.
Isn't the pettiness the point? How else are you going to punish someone? The other form of punishment they have on Red Dwarf is to make you not exist for 3 million years.
I mean, that's no. Well, I don't think that was their intention. But
all right, to not exist for a couple of weeks.
Yeah. You smuggled a cat on board. I am going to make sure you outlive me. Doesn't add up for me. I think that opening crawl, though, of him painting this vast ship with no portholes is for me the concept that they move away from. And actually, it's probably testament to it that they knowingly move away from Red Dwarf as well to Starbug as well. They purposefully lose the ship because the ship is vast and sad. And Starbug is the Millennium Falcon, so they can be a bit more fun about it.
I still think it's a comedic episode. I think existentially it's absurd, yes. Right? It's absurdist.
Yeah, almost. To be painting something that large on your own.
But also to be in an infinite prison.
Yes.
That is a contradiction in terms, right? But that's where he is.
Well, I love the end of the original Crichton episode where his setting off into the sunset is to borrow Lister's bike and just head off into Red Dwarf, where the implication is where they may never see him again because it's so big. That's a far more sci-fi idea than it is a space opera idea because it's haunting. It makes us uncomfortable. And that's the difference, I think, ultimately, is that sci-fi makes you go, you ever question this little comfortable part of yourself? And space opera goes, what if you could kill with impunity? Wait. What if there was more comfort? What if the stuff you felt uncomfortable about was actually fine? You know, that's the gift of Star Wars. They've got helmets on. Kill them.
It's just interesting, the little thoughts that occur to you that I'd completely forgiven and ignored or forgotten about when I was a kid, that now I just have a moment of going, oh, they'd die if they went backwards through that. But, oh no, they don't, because one way it's a split screen, the other way they fade in. And as a kid, I was like, why do they fade in if it's a door? What's that? Like, trying to pass the magic.
But that's it. Like, there's mystery to it still, you know. But they're alive when they go back through because they are of the future, I guess. I mean, it'd be a strange episode if when they walk through into the past, they turn to powder and then they just rolled credits.
End of the show.
End of show. Lister and the cat are now powder. Rimmer's standing there.
This is definitely a Lister episode, but it feels like Rimmer is the object of the episode, as it were.
Yes.
He had lemmings as a pet.
Well, that's just, it's such a joke line because it makes no sense.
It doesn't.
Does it? You can hear the studio audience laugh as soon as he mentions it because they know where it's going.
Oh, there's a few of those. He gets a few of those. The audience actually tread on a couple of punchlines, don't they? And he's not telegraphing necessarily, but we know enough to know what that joke is.
Yeah. Everything Leaves Him is the broad titles And then he mentions he had a pet lemming. Okay, okay.
You're bringing it upon yourself to an extent. Or maybe his parents forced a lemming on him as a pet to teach him that lesson, which he has clearly taken to heart.
I built him a little wall so he could hurl himself off it. It's just wonderful writing. It's hurl himself off it.
The writing, I'm sorry, can I also bring up the line, you ripped up and ate a photograph of his wife? Just out of context, that line is
yes,
so funny.
I love how they describe the escalation of Rimmer's madness that is so much better than if you'd actually seen it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's very true. There's some nice prop work and seed planting. Rimmer and Lister and the cat have a chat next to a fancy dress party poster. Anyone spot that? And then the next scene you get Hollister in a chicken costume. Yeah. Well done.
Right.
Well done, set design.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever noticed that, and yet I've never questioned why he's dressed as a chicken.
Right.
Never questioned.
I mean, there's always the chance that Rimmer hallucinated this whole thing in some kind of Jacob's Ladder scenario.
Hey, there's a get out.
there you go. What do you have a favourite scene or moment or line from this episode?
I think it's got to be the cat. The cat's what is it is sort of my favourite joke of the thing, just because it's so... I mean, it's not even beautifully the characters, because Lister and Rimmer calmly explaining something whilst the child doesn't get it. But it's just beautiful.
And we get four as well.
Yeah. The rule of four. But then Lister's speech, because I think it's in the corridor, because it's pure. Although I love the suitcases line as well. Now I'm saying it, just like, oh, bet they've sent him to the wrong bloody airport again. You know, just that is... It's Douglas Adams, isn't it? It's pure Douglas Adams.
It's a lot of Douglas Adams. Although the scary robot staff with the silver faces, that seems to be taken directly from THX-1138, right?
Right, yes.
They look identical to that. First time I saw it, I was like, oh, they must have just inherited some props off Doctor Who. That looks very Doctor Who.
Sure.
But I think it might be.
Or it's just like, that's what you do when you've got no money. You know, maybe that's what it is.
Silverhead in a tuxedo.
Silverhead. Turns out if you've got no money, everything's terrifying.
Can we loop back to that kick in the balls? Because I remember it being really good, and I was really a bit disappointed that iPlayer cut it out, and I don't really understand why either. You see the beginning of it, awkward cut, and you see the aftermath of it.
Yeah.
What was going on there, do you think? Did the Beeb go, it will encourage people to knee each other in their chicken costume balls?
I don't know. Sometimes it's just what they feel it does to the feel of it. I've heard that other great sitcom writers, you know, have had great debates about on-screen violence in a comedy setting, because, you know, if you're Rick and Aide, obviously the slapstick is baked into your world. But I know that Jesse Armstrong had long conversations about violence in Peep Show, because these are sort of real characters, you know, and when Jez is kicking his Mad Andy to therapize him because he's asking him to, and he's just kicking him on the floor in the balls and stuff. What you show is really important, because it changes how you feel about the person committing the violence. So I don't know. I'd have to see the kneeing in the chicken's balls again.
Is there not a possibility that late 20th century sitcom was psychologically violent enough, psychologically cruel, the characters to each other, that they didn't need actual punching and kicking to leave the audience bereft in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny thing, isn't it? Because these things are frozen in time, in stasis, if you like,
nice,
from the day they were filmed. And yet now, in a world of streaming services, they can be as present as something that was made last week. You know, and so the audience changes, but the show doesn't. And so that's why these conversations are constantly being had, and, you know, often wrong decisions being made or right ones being made. I mean, you don't want people to sit there and go, oh, at the end of your episode, you know. But I don't know. I'm broadly in the camp of leave things alone and let people make up their own minds. But I'm from the generation of where every TV edit or aeroplane edit completely butchered a film. So
yeah,
I'm just
thank
like,
goodness
oh,
they're not doing
God.
That anymore. Blimey.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd love to mention that Holly was in love once.
Oh, is it a ZX Spectrum?
Yeah. Incredibly timely reference. And I don't know. I think it sparks the imagination. Why would the ship's computer be programmed to be able to fall in love with anything, let alone an early 80s keyboard?
Right. Computer, sorry. I sort of love how specific the references are at this period in it. Like, they had no idea this would ever be shown again. Like, there's a line at the end to this day, I don't think I understand what it's about, which is when Future Lister in the hotel is closing the door on our Lister, and he says, at some point you'll end up in 1985 or something. You'll want to go to the theatre. Yes. Whatever you do, don't go see Run for Your Wife. And he closes the door and you're like, what? And it was just a famously bad play at the time. But it's like, nobody remembers a famously bad play from the mid-80s.
I could not name you a famously bad play now.
I mean, it became a famously bad film starring Danny Dyer.
Yeah. One star across the board, wasn't it? The clue's in the title, right?
But it's such an interesting choice that is where Lister talking to himself is left. That's the last thing they say to each other. It's like,
it's that important. But clearly he had that bad a time at the theatre. Do you not think it's maybe it was a final goading of Lister? Like, Lister thinks he's about to hear something important, and actually it's what old Lister did to Rimmer in way back in Series 1, Episode 2. Come closer.
They do revisit later, not in plot terms, but in just conceptual terms, of Lister and Rimmer become arseholes. Because future Lister's not... He's a bit of a dick, isn't he?
Yep.
You know, and they revisit that, you know... End of series 6, is it? Out of Time, I think.
Yeah, that's it. It is a pretty extraordinary. It must be 5, because 6, I think, ends with Rimmer kicking Death in the balls, which is...
Oh, no, that's 7, I think.
Is that 7? Oh, blimey, okay. We're lovers, not experts. Apologies, listener. Do we think that the despicable future end of series 6, Rimmer and Lister and Cat, do we think that's the same Rimmer and Lister that we see in Stasis
Well, that's
Stasis
what I'm
Leap?
Questioning, you know. They've been in deep space a long, long time by that point, so I don't know. I mean, the Lister Kachansky happily marries can't be a brain in a jar.
That's very true. Although I could see Rimmer getting that indolent.
Oh, yeah. But I love the comb-overs and the massive bellies and just the... We're used to the best the universe has to offer sort of attitude of just like, oh, God.
I wonder if at the time they'd known the show would run for another, like, on and off 15 years, that they might have been a little more careful about that characterization and the fat suits, frankly.
I think what's missing from the new ones is that they're not wroth of carning it and acknowledging as much as they could in an actually sad and yet poetic way about what it's like to... grow old without your circumstances changing, you know. Like, Wrath of Khan is everyone's favorite one because it's punctuation on the series. It's not just another movie, right? It's, you know, it's one more go at this out into the great beyond, and it's what they did so brilliantly in the most recent series of Picard as well, by just doing the same thing but writing it really well. Yeah, but they haven't done that. They've just still sort of... They're still on the treadmill, just going around. Nobody's mentioning it, you know? Because I feel like Rob Grant is the one who liked the sadness, and he's gone. So
it feels like that. Yeah, it feels like he's certainly the pessimist, maybe. Pessimist, but humanist.
I think he's the novelist, you know? And Doug Naylor's a gag writer. Like, it's why I think the bits that work in the new stuff the best are... cat scenes, because they're just monologues, they're just stupid routines and they're sort of joyous. Like, there's no reality to it, it's not grounded, but they're just little fun sketches. But anyway, I don't want to jump ahead for John, really.
It's all just tantalizing to me.
I think we've successfully gone through this episode line by line, scene by scene, and then there's very little else we could talk about, right? We could probably talk for another few hours, but we've taken up so much of your time already, David. Thank you so much.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's been lovely to get to wang on at length about a show I love. And I can't wait to hear everybody else wang on at length about it in other episodes.
That was Mr. David Reed. Thanks for the memory, David.
Yeah, and what a classic episode of a podcast. Thank you to Mr. Reed. I am a little disappointed, however.
Oh, yeah.
I was wearing this delightful T-shirt all the way through the episode. Neither of you said anything.
Oh, that's because you've covered it up with a fetching checkered shirt. That's Craig Charles on your chest.
That's Craig Charles holding a bazookoid.
Amazing.
With the number 25 written on it, and underneath it does say, "Let's get out there and twat it." It is the T-shirt.
It's that very
shirt. That I mentioned all the way back in Guy Kelly's episode. It was a birthday present to me from my lovely wife. What a cool thing.
Amazing.
This is the only circumstances in which I think I can wear it. Recording a Red Dwarf podcast.
It's probably good for just watching an episode on your couch, right?
Do you change for the telly?
Put it on for... I like to dress as the characters, yeah.
I love this T-shirt so much more than I thought I would and did as a teenager. I was like, oh, that's so uncool, wearing a thing that lets people know that you like a thing. But now I'm fine with the things I like. Yeah. I'm doing a podcast about them, for crying out loud.
Exactly. Yeah, it's not. Yeah, that you're well past the gateway drug of a T-shirt at this point, aren't you? What's the 25 a reference to? Was that like an anniversary special re-release or something?
I bet there's a cooler reason. You know, in Aliens, they all have like cool things written on their helmets and guns, like adios and cooler things than that.
Yeah.
Listener, if you know why Dave Lister has 25 written on his bazookoid. Yeah. Maybe there's a rack of 30 of them. He pulled out the 25th one.
Yes, if you know the answer.
But if there's a better, different reason.
Email us.
Yeah, let us know.
At betterthanlifepod@gmail.com, as the wonderful Sam has done, to share a moment that means a lot that we didn't really talk about in Thanks for the Memory last week.
Ooh.
Yeah, a brilliant bit of Thanks for the Memory that wasn't mentioned on the pod was when Rimmer was desperately trying to make the oddities into an alien message. Paraphrasing, it hurts like hell, it's below the knee, there's two of them.
So good.
And then...
How do we not mention that?
I know, it's mad, isn't it, that we didn't talk about this everything. Actually thinking about it, especially given how much we love Rimmer's crazy alien conspiracy theories.
Oh, so good.
Sam points out how it's almost thrown away in the delivery, in the jigsaw must mean you. There's no logic behind it at all at that point, but he just needs it. He needs it to mean you. So, oh, the jigsaw must mean you. It is great. It's really well set up, that gag. Obviously to make hello to you from the aliens. And it's only in the final seconds that we realise the jigsaw actually does reference them, because it is a jigsaw of the Red Dwarf. And we didn't mention that either, the fact that the jigsaw is actually of the ship.
Oh, yeah.
For goodness sake, what kind of podcast are we?
A reasonable one, because it is an unusual... It's a weird one. The puzzle is a photo of the end of Red Dwarf. The front end, I think. It shouldn't be a puzzle. It is only that because that's the first moment of the end credits sequence. So it's kind of putting the cart before the horse a little bit to say, no, that's what it meant. Because actually, they were doing that because it would look cool, right? Rather than it being it is you that... Or it's just all deliberate and they're geniuses. Oh, yeah, let's go with that.
Yeah.
To be fair, they made it a real puzzle. They didn't try and kind of superimpose the shot onto a blank puzzle and try and make that work.
Yeah.
They actually printed it. So they did go with that aesthetic.
Yeah, they committed to this bit. Yeah, they did. Sam, you're right to say that since we didn't mention it, you thought you'd write in and you hope we like it. And we do like it.
Yeah,
so thank
really
you.
Do.
Loving the podcast, Sam also says.
Oh, that's nice.
I have to read that bit out because it makes me feel warm inside.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. That's very nice.
And we love you listening, Sam, and we love you writing in as well.
Yeah, and reminding us of jokes that we didn't mention.
Yeah. So I think we've now thoroughly analysed Thanks for the Memory.
Surely there's nothing left.
Certainly thoroughly analysed Stasis Lee.
Oh, yeah, can't go any further than that.
Next week, we've got a thoroughly analysed Quee.
With Sarah Mills. That's going to be amazing.
Yay.
See you there.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.